Instead, I live from day to day just practicing my Spanish and doing a little else. See, that's the whole business about this IRS business, is that the law is not what the law says anymore. It's what a judge says. The judge will bend the law. He will do not allow you to bring witness, will not allow you to bring evidence. And so if you're an average person up there and try to plead your case in a tax court, believe me, you're going to see the inside of the slammer, because a lot of very knowledgeable people have tried to do the same, and the same is their same fate. So that's why I'm saying that you and I as average people should not try to do this on our own unless you're fully prepared to deal with these snakes in the pit. And but otherwise, I think as we have to come together as a movement and get rid of this whole abomination, because again and again, I don't know how many ways I can say it, you cannot be free and have an IRS. You can have one or the other, but you cannot be free as long as an IRS exists. And we really need to abolish it, get rid of it, move on to sales tax, tariffs tax, whatever it takes. And of course, these are only symptoms of this whole monetary system. They're very much interdigitated. They're interlocked between the Federal Reserve System and the IRS. The IRS is indeed the collection agency for the Federal Reserve System, and to fix one, you have to fix the other. They're hand in glove, and they both need to be addressed. There are some groups and people out there that are trying to change the whole system, and but I have not seen a real solid body of folks that are doing. I see organizations called Citizens for a Sound Economy, but it doesn't seem quite tight enough what they're talking about. Now, so talking about an average person out there dealing with the IRS, I strongly urge people, just go ahead, go along with the system for now. But you should be channeling your extra money and time, if you have an issue with this, as I do, towards organizations that are actually trying to do something to change it. I don't think it does any good to stand up there and get your head whacked off. You're much more useful in this movement if you're out there educating people, handing out flyers, sending things out in the mail, telling your friends about it. Just educating people. Just what we need to do at this point is just educate, educate, educate. Just keep spreading the information. There's some great sites on the internet where all of this business is here. One of the very best books I've ever seen on the IRS is called Goodbye April 15th by Boston Tea Party. It's kind of a tough book to get, but if you start searching the internet, I'm sure you'll find a modern site where all that is, and where you can pick up some information on that in terms of acquiring. Well, we're down to our last few minutes. If you have any personal stories or thoughts, you're welcome to call again at 464-8295, 464-8295. So if you as an average person out there would have a tough time, well, think about Joe Bannister. Now, he was a former IRS agent. I've interviewed him something like four or five times now on the radio. And recently, they've gone after him. He basically went as an IRS employee, gun-toting and so forth. He went to his employers after hearing a show, a talk show about the IRS. He investigated the IRS and what they were saying on the talk show for about a year, and he went to his employers and said, is this true? All my research seems to indicate, number one, that indeed the 16th Amendment was never passed, and number two, it just doesn't apply to the average person. Would you please answer these questions? Well, instead of answering the questions, what did they do? They tossed him out on his ear and asked him to leave, which so he's no longer, he had a great job. He was pulling in 80 grand a year and all the benefits and perks and everything else you could think. He was on Easy Street, and now he's far from it. I mean, going around and giving lots of talks across the country, and he's doing his fair share to educate, educate, educate. But they've come after him, and what they're doing is when he appears before them, he has all these witnesses and he has all this information. The judge won't allow him to present any of this information. So if they're doing that to him, think what they would do to you. There's a fellow, Dan Pilla, who teaches people how to interact with the IRS. But I like some of these comments. I see one of these little promotional flyers he puts out. I'll just read a couple phrases. Join the general public's annual cattle drive to H&R Block. He's saying that's a bit of a mistake. And then he talks about the fraudulent practice of the IRS of sending out these automated demand notices that are sent out in the mail, and most people are intimidated, and they just pay up without any confrontation. And he says 1 in 3 taxpayers have been hit by this scam. That's what I mean. This is getting more and more intense all the time. One of the my great primary objections to the IRS is the fact that it is such a crushing attack on the freedom of speech. Bill Clinton, in particular, went after his political adversaries using the IRS audit system. He prosecuted all the women that came to him with charges right down the line, all the so-called conservative organizations that he did not like. He had them all audited. And this has been a practice that's been in existence since the days of John F. Kennedy. And all the presidents through since then have used the IRS as a billy club to slam their political adversaries. And particularly they're using this business of the free speech where they go after you and use all these obscure laws to suppress political adversaries. They went recently after Irwin Schiff. Irwin Schiff's quite a character. He's a fellow in his 70s. He's been battling the IRS for decades. He wrote a book called The Federal Mafia, How It Illegally Imposes and Unlawfully Collects Income Taxes, because there's no legal requirement to pay income taxes. And they're trying to get him to stop giving seminars and stop selling his book. And he said, I will plead guilty to all the charges if they can show me a law in the code that says persons earning income are liable for income taxes. And but he's no lightweight player. What is he up against? 40 years of imprisonment, $325 million in fines, $2.5 million in taxes and interest and penalties. I must say, how many of us get to that point in life where we're supposedly owe the government over $5 million? It's quite an achievement for Mr. Schiff in his short 76 years on the planet. But again, I have to say it again, just like they tried to go after this woman, Vernice Kuglin, the FedEx pilot. She was there. They had the best prosecutors the IRS had. They used everything they could. They had there to convince the jury that she needed to pay her taxes, and she kept saying, show me the law, show me the law. Don't you think the IRS, if they could have shown that jury that law, they would have brought it out and said, this is the law, and this is what she did, and she broke the law, and therefore prosecute her, but and deliver us a guilty verdict. But all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't convict Vernice Kuglin. But you have to realize what you're up against. So, folks, just educate, educate, educate yourself and others. And I'll see you next Monday. Thank you very much for listening.
Hail, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening Mrs. Coeyer. Of course, she wrote the book about her son, A Martyr Speaks, Journal of the Late John Allen Coey. Miss Coey, are you there?
I surely am. Good evening, Pastor Stan.
I really appreciate so much of being with us. Well, I'm not really a pastor. They call me Dr. Stan. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon, and I have a ministry.
I think I said Dr. Stan.
Okay, maybe you did.
Okay.
Anyway, the important thing is that we understand a little bit about your son and what motivated him to go halfway around the world to fight for freedom, because he recognized what was going on in America. Now, he, of course, attended college in 1968, he graduated in 1972, and the Vietnam War was still going on. He didn't want to take off and go to Canada or be a draft dodger, but he also recognized the futility of the Vietnam War, didn't he?
That's correct.
And, the difficulty was that most of our young people didn't understand what Vietnam was all about. Some of them wanted the communists to win. There were people who wanted the communists to win. There were others who were cowards. There were some people who opposed the war, but they opposed it for the wrong reasons. I opposed initially supported the war, and then it became obvious we weren't really trying to win the war. We were simply sending our boys over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but eventually it became obvious we were financing the North Vietnamese, as we had all along. We'd put restrictions on the ability of our men to win the war. We weren't allowed to bomb the major targets. We weren't allowed to bomb the rail yards in Haiphong or mine the harbor at Haiphong or even sink a ship in the mouth of the inlet there, as the French had done. They would have blocked the supplies coming in that were being used to kill our boys. We couldn't bomb the dikes. We couldn't bomb the power plants. We couldn't bomb any of the major targets. Our planes were forced to fly sorties every day with a third of a load of bombs, so three planes would take up one load of bombs and maybe one pilot would get shot down. It was all a make-believe war. Did your son recognize what was really going on over there?
Yes, indeed he did. We did as a family. We also had an elder son and who took his stand too. Now our younger son John realized that we were, as we did as a family, that the American people never became informed enough to know that they were victims of psychological warfare.
Of course.
And they were never aware that we'd been forced into playing an old political game. It was called the choice between false alternatives. And our John just would not be a part of that. And of course, upon graduation from Ohio State University, he was to be drafted and sent to Vietnam.
Now, and he probably would have gone in as an officer. He'd been in ROTC, hadn't he?
He started out in ROTC, yes, sir. And then during that brief training that he had there, he wanted to put his uniform on, his Marine uniform on, and go proudly to visit our capital, Washington, D.C. And they weren't allowed to do it.
All right, you hold on that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment or two. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mrs. Coey, and she's John Allen Coey's mother. And we're talking about Vietnam, because it was during this period of Vietnam that John made the fateful decision that he was going to fight this international conspiracy, which he realized was behind the war, but he was going to fight it in a country where it would appear that they were really fighting the communist enemy, and that would be in Rhodesia. What most people don't understand is the United States government has funded communism since its very inception, and all you need to do is look at, read your newspaper carefully, the Wall Street Journal. We're always finding some new reason to give money to Russia, even to this very day. But you go back to where it was in 1918, if you've read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, we point out that when Russia was starving in the aftermath of the First World War, and, of course, all of Europe was starving, but Russia was certainly starving, and people were dying of hunger, and we sent a relief mission and gave millions and millions of dollars worth of food and medical supplies, 97% of it to the small area where the communists controlled, and 3% of it to where the anti-communists controlled. You couldn't do something like that unintentionally. And then as you read the writings of the people who were in Moscow immediately after the war, you find that they were working very closely with representatives of the American and the British government. And in the one book, British Agent, which we have a copy of, why the author, Bruce Lockhart, who had been sent to Russia to monitor what was happening there under Lenin, was amazed to find out that Lenin would come to him and to the representative of the Federal Reserve Bank for advice on how Russia should be run during those terrible, terrible times when the Civil War was still going on. And, of course, we were helping to finance the communists to defeat the anti-communists, and it's a pattern that's gone on ever since then. We created the best enemy our money could buy. And this is what happened in Vietnam. How could a little country the size of the North Vietnam, the size of the state of Mississippi, fight the largest and most powerful country in the world for a period of 10 years and lose the war unintentionally? Because we never went there to win. And your son really recognized that, didn't he?
Yes, indeed he did. We kept hearing on the news that there was this little country in southern Africa, Rhodesia, and it was a threat to world peace. And, of course, looking into the situation further, and here was this peaceful country with full employment. They exported food. There was no racial attention going on.
There was no racial discrimination there. Everybody was equal under the law. Hold just a moment, please.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Mrs. Coey. We're talking about her book, A Martyr Speaks, the journal of John Allen Coey. So you thought that perhaps somehow Rhodesia had something to do with what was going on in the world today, and of course Rhodesia was involved in a civil war there, and the people they were fighting were communists. The communists had organized there, and they were trying to overthrow the Rhodesian government. The Rhodesian government was democratically elected. Their blacks could vote just as well as whites could. Yes, the whites controlled the vast majority of the land, but at least the blacks were employed, and they had, they could own land as well. If they could save up money, they could buy land. But the communists wanted to take over control of that country, and so there was a civil war going on. So anyway, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay. Of course, this was a power struggle by the internationalist cabal, too, because of the vast mineral wealth and resources of the country. Rhodesia had the best chrome in the world, and as I said, had declared their independence from Britain, as we had done. They declared theirs in 1965. So anyhow, John decided that he would not stay in the ROTC. He was not against serving somehow, someplace, in an honorable way. And so he chose, as an individual, to go to Rhodesia. And just before he left, he had written his essay called A Soldier's Protest. He didn't run. He didn't hide. And he sent this soldier's protest to all of his congressmen, all of his state, federal representatives, his pastor, his family, friends, everybody. And in his soldier's protest, he listed three things as to the reason why he made this decision to go serve in Rhodesia. And one was the deliberate prevention of the United States government of victory over communist forces in Southeast Asia. Two, the attempted overthrow of the Constitutional Republic of the United States by a revolutionary conspiracy of internationalists, collectivists, communists in and out of the U.S. government. And three, the attempted destruction by government defense officials of the fighting capabilities of American combat forces. And it's about 2 pages long. It's in his journal. This is his personal journal that we have that he kept the 3.5 years that he served. And so he left for Rhodesia the day after he graduated from Ohio State University. He served there 3.5 years. His final service there was as a medic. And what actually was going on, the security forces there were simply trying to keep the communist-trained terrorists out of the country. And you see, Mozambique to the north had been taken over. These communist-trained terrorists would come in over the borders into Rhodesia and many times kidnap the innocent black people, the younger people there, and they would take them. Some were sent to Cuba, some to the Eastern Bloc countries at that time, on into Mozambique, and they were trained in this Marxist ideology and then sent back into Rhodesia to terrorize their own people.
I'll never forget, I flew into Botswana back in 1975. I was in a small Cessna plane. I guess it was 1976, and I had a plane. I was practicing medicine. I worked at a University of Orange Free State, and we landed at a place called Francistown in Botswana. And the man there at the tower was an Englishman, and he told me that he remembered the day when they'd come, and they had all these children they'd kidnapped from Rhodesia, hundreds of them, and they were all being marched onto a plane. These were children 6 to 8 years of age, kidnapped from their families, and they were being taken off to other communist countries to be trained as a cadre for the world revolution. And they were all the little girls in their neat dresses and little boys. But of course, they'd been taken from their families, and they'd never see their families again. And how, you know, there was nothing he could do about it, that Botswana was allowing the communists to use his airfield that he worked. He was employed by the Botswana government, but the Botswana government worked hand in glove with the World Revolutionary Forces as long as they'd leave them alone. And all these little children were leaving forever, at least living in that area, would never again see their families. So this was very, very common, but we never heard about that here in the United States, nor did we hear about that when they had elections in Rhodesia and they elected a black moderate. His name was Bishop Maseweo. We didn't want a black moderate. We wanted a communist, and we insisted they have another election and elect Mugabe, which they did. He was a hardline communist. He is the man. He's been the dictator there now for 20 years, and now, of course, the country's in tatters. The people are starving, 50% unemployment, 1,000% inflation, a nation totally chaotic. People who get out of line are kidnapped, tortured, disappear. But we don't hear about it in America because, after all, we brought Mugabe to power, and Henry Kissinger promised that if this sort of thing ever happened, America would come to their help. And, well, the tragedy was that the people there believed Henry Kissinger because he spoke for the American people. And men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And Henry Kissinger is an evil man. Henry Kissinger has betrayed every president, every buddy he ever worked for. And, of course, he represents this international cabal that you speak of, one of the most powerful men in the world. And he was the one who personally betrayed the people of Rhodesia to the chaos they're in today. But anyway, let's get back to 1972, and your son's going to go to Rhodesia because he thinks maybe he can make a difference there.
That's correct. He says, since I do not object, this is what he had written, since I do not object to military service, I chose to serve in the Rhodesian Army, where I may perhaps help sustain civilization in Africa. And he says, it's the most I can do for my country under the circumstances. And so, as I said, he served there 3.5 years. In 19, 75. He was serving as a medic, and they were caught in an ambush by the communist-trained terrorists there, and he gave his life trying to save his wounded men. And he, as I said, he had kept this personal journal the whole 3.5 years. He kept it from the day he left until the time of his death. And not for personal glory. He had hoped to get back, of course, to have the truth published. And so the journal contains two things. It contains, of course, all the political truth of what was actually going on and his personal Christian witness. Now, the Rhodesian Light Infantry had a policy at that time for the medics that the wounded would be brought to a base camp. And John would not hear to that at all. He said, no, I will always go out with my fire force, with my men, to be there not only to tend to them medically, but to be on the spot to witness to them for Jesus Christ. And so that was his main purpose. And, of course, now he Rhodesia did not take mercenaries. There were other Americans, there were actually men from all over the world that, as individuals, went there to help out. And, of course, that was not told that way in the media. They were depicted as mercenaries. And, of course, Rhodesia did not take mercenaries. John got $100 a month. He had to provide his own canvas shoes that he wore, his own medic's bag. And I think when you serve under those conditions, I think that's out of dedication.
I'm sure it was. How did he see the world? How did he understand who was really running the world? How did he understand Vietnam? Because Vietnam was never fought for the reasons that we were told. We were not fighting communism because all during that time we were giving massive amounts of money to Russia so that they could provide the massive funds and supplies for the North Vietnamese so we could keep that war going for 10 long years. And the real purpose was, of course, to transform America. If you doubt that, you can read the writings of McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bones, Council on Foreign Relations, National Security Advisor, held a position that Condoleezza Rice does today. And he was the architect of that war, just as his good friend Henry Stimson, Skull and Bones, CFR, Secretary of War during World War II, had gotten us into the Second World War so that McGeorge Bundy got us into Vietnam and kept that war going for such a long period of time. But wars are how you change society. And your son recognized, I don't think he understood all the ins and outs, but he understood there was a cabal behind what was going on, didn't he?
Well, we worked very hard as a family to keep ourselves informed. We run study groups in our home at one time for 9 consecutive years, and our sons participated in that. And they were very eager to learn and to know. And, of course, they were growing up in the midst of all the turmoil that was going on. They were in high school and going on into college during the riots and barely getting off campus sometimes when the shooting was going on. And we worked very, very hard at informing ourselves, and we were very blessed to have our sons not get caught up in the false alternatives that were going on. And they understood the enemy. As my other son wrote the introduction here for his brother's journal, and he's in the introduction, he says, during the Vietnam era, there was one young American who understood demoralization by the choice of false alternatives. His name was John Allen Coe, and he was determined to resist being manipulated by the hostile and alien forces which had captured his government.
And, Chris, what they do is they have the pro-war group and they have the anti-war group, and they finance and support both of them.
Both sides.
And this is what they're doing today. You have your anti-war groups, all not only here across America, but throughout the world. Who's funding these? Why, the great tax-exempt foundations. The same people we talk about who are funding so much of what's going on. And then the communists are there. But then who funds the communist movement throughout the world? If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to read it. You need to understand that we have funded communism since its inception, and even the Communist Party here in the United States. We can talk a little bit more about that when we get back here at Radio Liberty. But they will never tell you, if you read the communist publications as I do on a weekly basis, they will never tell you who the real enemy is. They're just the wicked capitalists, the wicked Republicans. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Mrs. Coley, and we're talking about her a book that she wrote based upon her son's journal, A Martyr Speaks, the journal of the late John Allen Coley, who died in Rhodesia in 1975, because he believed in individual freedom. He felt that that he was combating by military means this international conspiracy, but of course you can't defeat them by military means, because behind this whole conspiracy are the dark spiritual forces that have been there manipulating mankind since the inception of civilization. And of course, this is the message that we try to get out. This is what we have learned by studying this for 43 years. This is a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, economic, financial battlefield. And the great tragedy is most people don't even understand the battle is going on. They're just swept up in the crisis of the day, as the people who manipulate our media create new crises, and we think that we're really seeing what's going on, but we never really do. So, John, of course, was he accepted by the Rhodesians over there? Did he like Rhodesia? Did he like the people there as a whole?
Yes, he did. He often was not fully understood, but he always managed to pick up the pieces, so to speak. He had a lot of times when he was let down, but he always picked up the pieces and went on. I'd like to quote from 14th of October 1972 that he wrote, and this the journal is compiled of his own writings. And he said, "I think the Christian soldier should be, as was said of Robert E. Lee, a foe without hate, a friend without treachery, a soldier without cruelty, a public officer without vice, a public citizen without wrong, and a Christian without hypocrisy. He ought to strive to be Caesar without his ambition, Frederick without his tyranny, and Napoleon without his selfishness." That was one quote from his journal here that he had written. The people of Rhodesia at the time of John's death, they had a group called the Terrorist Relief Fund, and they provided a way for my husband and our son Ed and I to go over for John's full military funeral. We had to make a decision on what to do, of course, and so we were over there, and it was just a beautiful, civilized, even with all they've been through, civilized, beautiful country. The people, well, there are people of our civilization, and you know that from having, I'm sure, lived in South Africa at the time.
Sure, I was there in 1975.
Right. And so we were there for a full military funeral for John, and I had made John a promise that if anything ever happened, I would never quit until his journal was published. Well, we couldn't find the journal when we got there. We had to come home without it. We were devastated. And a year later, we got the journal. Some of the political aspects of it had been censored, but someone got a hold of it. We don't know who, smuggled it through South Africa, and we got it a year later. And so John always wrote directly from his journal in his letters. And so my son Ed and I pieced it all together then, and that's how we got the manuscript together, to tell the story, and it took me 13 years to get a publisher for it.
Well, I'm glad you did, and we're going to tell people in just a moment how they can get copies.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Mrs. Coley, and we're talking about A Martyr Speaks, journal of the late John Allen Coley, a young man who, after he graduated from college in 1968, went over to Rhodesia to fight, because he felt that he might be able somehow, by saving Rhodesia, to help to save Western civilization. Now, how can people get copies of the book?
Well, they can get it directly from us. The second publisher lets me have the books on consignment, and then I try to pay for them and pay for the shipping, and then people like you make it possible for the story to keep going.
All right. How can people reach you?
Right. You can reach us by ordering the book from George Coey, that's C-O-E-Y, Our address is 6555, that's U.S. Highway 68 South. You can just put the letters U.S. and then the abbreviation Highway 68 South, apartment E14. The town is two words, is West Liberty. West Liberty, Ohio, 43357. And the book is $20, includes postage.
All right, fine. That's 6555. It's George Coey, C-O-E-Y, 6555. U.S. Highway 68 South, apartment E14, West Liberty, Ohio, 43357. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, fine. We'll try to get that out in the next half hour as well. Looking back on this, of course, a lot of history has gone by. I was in South Africa at the time when Henry Kissinger betrayed Rhodesian people. He put pressure on South Africa to cut off the supply of gasoline. And how can a country survive without gasoline? They did everything they could to isolate Rhodesia. And by isolating Rhodesia, why, they forced it to make the concessions and to elect a known communist, Robert Mugabe. That was what was so unconscionable. They were quite willing to have somebody who would represent the blacks and the whites, but they knew that Mugabe represented Moscow, and we brought him to power. What the average American doesn't really understand is we brought Fidel Castro to power back in 1959. If anybody doubts that, you can read the book written by the American ambassador. It's called The Fourth Floor by Ambassador Earl Smith, who I had a privilege of interviewing, and it was very obvious talking to him. We knew Fidel Castro was a communist. The American government ordered the president of Cuba, Mr. Batista, to leave the following day, knowing full well we'd bring Fidel Castro to power, but we couldn't let the American people know that any more than we could let them know that Nelson Mandela in South Africa is a communist and we brought him to power. The gentleman, the dictator of Southwest Africa, is a communist. We, of course, support the communist government in Angola. People don't really can't imagine why we would do this sort of thing. Aren't we anti-communist? And the truth of the matter is, no, we're not anti-communist. We are pro-New World Order, and these organizations, these people, these countries support the New World Order. Oh, yes, we get rid of a communist every once in a while when he isn't doing what we want, like we did with Allende, certainly in Chile. But, certainly many other communists we put in power. We're currently keeping the dictator of Uzbekistan, who's a communist, in power, and the dictator of Turkmenistan in power. He's a communist. We have kept these communists in power all throughout the area there around Afghanistan right now. About three or four of the stand governments, we have our troops stationed there, and every one of the dictators of those former communist governments is himself a former communist. So every one of them is a dictatorship, and there's no freedom there at all. But the American people can't understand. They can't believe that, because we're told, oh, we want democracy. Well, so did Karl Marx. And if you read the Communist Manifesto, he keeps talking about the importance of democracy, just exactly like our leaders do as well, because behind all of this are these spiritual forces we talk about. Looking back on what your son wrote, Ms. Coy, he had a grasp that there was another force behind what was going on, didn't he?
Yes, he understood the spiritual warfare that that we are involved in. And what grieves me so today is to see the situation in Iraq. And I know we're going to reinstate the draft again. I know that's coming.
But, of course, the American people haven't been told that's the plan. It'll only come about when there just has to be done. The government doesn't want to, but there's just no other alternative. And, of course, every patriot will support it. Unfortunately, they're supporting the deaths of our young people unnecessarily.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is Mrs. Coey. We're talking about the A Martyr Speaks, the journal of the late John Allen Coey, who went over to Rhodesia to fight for freedom and died fighting for freedom in Rhodesia in 1975. It's almost 25 years ago now, isn't it?
Well, actually, it's 32 years since he left.
Right.
Uh-huh. And some people will say, you know, well, that's so long ago. What does that have to do with anything now? Well, it has everything to do with what's going on right now. And what the journal does is connect the dots for people between what was going on then in Vietnam and what's going on now. And I would like to give credit to, there were, as I said, there were even some Vietnam veterans who realized that they were sold out, and as individuals, they went over to help out in Rhodesia too. And in fact, we have a letter here that was written in January of 1978. It's from a Vietnam veteran from Illinois. And he sent us this letter. He said, there are very few people in this country who can see through the smokescreen the mass media throws forth and put the real picture together. Even fewer yet will sacrifice their time and risk their lives in doing what they believe is the right thing. Without trying to inflate my own ego, I'd say John and I were two of these individuals. And this young man was serving with 2nd Commando in the Rhodesian Light Infantry. And he was put in John's place as a medic right after John was killed. And then this young man stepped on a landmine and lost both legs. And he's saying here, when I was blown up, I was serving with 2nd Commando RLI, the same unit John was with when he was killed. And I can't count the number of people who have asked me if I had known John Coey, and several said we were alike in many ways. I took this as a compliment because everyone I talked to had nothing but great respect and admiration for your son, and I was very proud to fill his place for a while. And I want to say, Dr. Stan, now this journal was not done for any personal glory. It certainly wasn't done for money. It was done, first of all, to the glory of God and for the truth. And that's what John would want. And, of course, what we would want is a family. And one good place to put this journal, of course, is for the homeschoolers. It's a very authentic history book at this time and very good for homeschoolers to have.
Well, I think it's important that people understand the history. You can't understand what's going on today unless you understand Vietnam.
That's right.
A war that was never fought to win. They wouldn't allow our boys to win. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Right now, we're going to invite your questions. If you're out across America, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And right now, we've got Daryl calling from Pennsylvania. Hi, Daryl. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan and Phyllis. This is Daryl Eberhardt, Crescent, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Daryl.
Hi. And Dr. Stan, I want to thank you for having Phyllis on. And when I first got a little cover of the book, a picture of it, and from Phyllis, and I thought, oh, do I want to just read some diary of a guy saying he got up and brushed his teeth and he went for a little march that day? This book was so much more than that, and it had so many great quotations in it. And Dr. Stan, as you know, I put together a booklet of quotations. I put over 2 pages of quotes by John Allen Coey in there, and I'd like to read just 2 short ones, and I urge everybody to get this book because this young man in his early 20s, Dr. Stan, learned more or knew more about what was going on in the world, how the globalists were fomenting wars and revolutions than I did working in the intelligence community for 26 years, and what I learned in my late 40s, he knew in his early 20s. And here's 2 great quotes, and I think they'll really move you, Dr. Stan. John Allen Coey said, I want to be a soldier, a warrior, a crusader for my God and country, and to fight the hell-inspired enemy that would crush every delicate and beautiful creation of this world. I want to be a free man, the master of my own destiny, not a pawn of usurpers and traitors who manipulate the masses into subservience. I want to do God's will and fulfill the purpose of my creation. And one very other short one. But the greater battle is for the Western people to regain control of their nations and destinies and to drive out the usurpers, aliens, and traitors that run our governments. Just beautiful quote after beautiful quote in this book. And again, I urge folks to get it. And I also urge them to get your book, Dr. Stan. It was mentioned earlier today, Brotherhood of Darkness, because the secret societies really do pull the strings all around the globe.
And it's about time the American people realized that they have usurped our electoral process. And in November, we're going to have one member of the Skull and Bones running against another member of the Skull and Bones, one member of the Council on Foreign Relations running against a man whose father was the director of the CFR and who has intentionally surrounded himself with people from the Council on Foreign Relations, people like Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, and we can go right through the administration. They control the administration, and the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created in 1891. Anybody doubts that? You get Professor Quigley's book. Professor Quigley was Bill Clinton's mentor, a world-renowned historian. On page 952 of his book, Tragedy and Hope, he talks about where the Council on Foreign Relations came from, established in America in 1921 as a front group for the Small American Roundtable Group and for J.P. Morgan and Company. And, of course, the Small American Roundtable Group was the front group for this English secret society. But the average American has never heard this sort of thing, and they're certainly not going to hear it from Rush Limbaugh or from Bill O'Reilly. So go ahead. Anything else you want to say there, Darryl?
One final thing, Dr. Stan, and that is I urge everybody to either get one of your catalogs or to go up on your website, radioliberty.com, and look at all the wonderful informational tools that you have about the Vietnam War tape sets, about our MIAPOWs. You've got a lot of great materials there, Dr. Stan, and I just want to say thank you to you and Barbara for all you do, and thank you, Phyllis, and God bless you both.
Bye-bye. God bless you, too.
Thank you, Darryl.
And our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But we have to let the American people know that these wars are all contrived. And once the war gets started, then, of course, the hatreds tend to grow, and the hatreds on both sides. This is exactly what Samuel Huntington said in his book, The Clash of Civilizations, back in 1996. This is how you get a world war started. You have one side killing the other, and then you have the other side committing atrocities, and then, of course, you retaliate against the atrocities, and then people from both sides get drawn in, and there's more anger and more hatred, and pretty soon you have a world war going. And this is how you manipulate, how you create a war. This is how you create hatreds. In fact, as Samuel Huntington said in the opening page of his book, unless we hate what we are not, we cannot love what we are. Unless we hate what we are not, we cannot love what we are. That is truly a terrible thought, and yet that is exactly what Samuel Huntington, the people he represents, are fomenting. They want to get us to become haters, and that's the last thing we ever want to allow ourselves to do, because then we would renounce the faith that we hold to. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment about anything we're saying. Maybe you think that the wars are wonderful. Maybe you think that the Spanish-American War was a wonderful war. We really should have gone to war in 1917. Or the Second World War was justified because Hitler was such a bad man, but nobody ever points out he was largely funded by American capitalists and British capitalists, and he was encouraged at every step as he went into Alsace-Lorraine in Austria and into the Sudetenland by members of this secret society we've talked about. And you can get that at Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Time, or if you want to verify the exact source of that material, you may want to get my syllabus, Iraq, The Untold Story. You'll actually see the pages from Professor Quigley's book where it tells about how that was this group that was encouraging Adolf Hitler. And now we have this terrible Second World War with literally 60 million people dead and twice that many people maimed and damaged, and many of them will carry the pain of their wounds to their death. and now we're moving into World War III, and the average person doesn't understand. This is all being engineered. It's being created, and it's about time the American people understood how wars are done and what Plato said, writing 2,350 years ago, about how when the tyrant is defeated, the enemy, and either by treaty or by a conquest, then he's always out looking for a new enemy so he can unite the people behind him. Or read the book, Report from Iron Mountain, supposedly put out by a group of government experts, a government think tank, that told about how war was the uniting thing, that way that you organized and mobilized society. And if you didn't have war, what were you going to do? You had to come up with some sort of an enemy to rally the people behind the government, because that's how you got your people behind the leaders. And it's about time the American people understood history, because if we don't understand history, we're condemned to repeat it, as George Santayana said so well. Well, you know, when you went to Rhodesia, this was, what, 1975?
He was killed in 1975.
Right,
yes,
that's
sir.
When you went over there?
He went over in 1972.
Oh, no, but you went over there.
Oh, when we went over, yes, for his funeral, 1975, yes, sir.
Whereabouts in Rhodesia is he buried?
He was buried in Kwekwe, Rhodesia, and then we come home and had a memorial service for him, and then we have an addendum now to the story, Dr. Stan. We're friends with a very valiant lady there. She was the Right Honorable Viscountess Patricia Malvern, just a very common lady to know, though, even though she had this title. And she didn't want John to lie buried in the heathen Marxist country that Rhodesia had become in 1980. So at the risk of her life and at her own expense, she had John's body taken up and sent back to Ohio. He's buried in Hideaway Hills, Ohio, where he lived when he left for Rhodesia. And so we have him buried there now. And so we had three services in all. We had another service for him when he was brought back to be reburied. Because those who had resisted, as John did many times, their graves were desecrated then. And she didn't want that to happen. So, and she has since passed away. I think she literally died of a broken heart.
Well, Rhodesia was a beautiful country, and it was a great country, and the blacks were prospering, and they were getting an education, they were getting ahead, and now there's 50% unemployment. The people are helpless. They're being slaughtered by the man that we brought to power, the Marxist Mugabe.
Well, see, this Mugabe is committing genocide against his own black people.
Sure, he's actually starving those who
do
not.
Against the Shonas. He's a Matabele, and they're committing genocide against the other tribe. The Shonas actually were very peaceful people, and so they're being literally killed along with the white farmers. Their farms have been taken over, and I have a recent newsletter from a Episcopal pastor who had to go back to Britain. He'd been in Rhodesia for many, many years, and he brings us up to date on this. He says, for brutality, torture, and terror, it is scarcely rivaled in today's world with the Mugabe there.
Well, the great tragedy is the American people are not being told what's going on in Rhodesia. Well, they focus our attention on certain specific things to take our attention off of other things, because you cannot have attention on too many things at one time. Our minds just don't function that way. So we worry about Toby Bryant. We worry about Martha Stewart. We worry about all of these things, certainly Scott Peterson. And all of these issues are put in the forward when they're slaughtering, you know, people in not only in Rhodesia, but in other countries, you know, and a couple of hundred people can die in a country and they can be brutally slaughtered, and you get a little tiny article, maybe about 2 inches long, under the Patrostat in the back pages of your paper, and you're totally unaware of what's going on and how they can focus our attention on certain issues and then totally ignore others. And you do that when you control the media. And the media in America has been controlled for many years by people associated with the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you doubt that, you need to read the article by Richard Harwood, who was the ombudsman for the, of all places, the Washington Post. The article was written in October of 1993. And he simply points out that the Council on Foreign Relations is the closest thing the United States has to a ruling elite. Well, I don't think it's the closest thing. I think it is the ruling elite.
Absolutely.
But it's certainly part of the ruling elite. There are other many other organizations that interlock with it, but they all have a common denominator, a one world government. And this is what most people do not understand, is that a new world religion. But I think that probably your son did recognize the spiritual aspects of this, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He realized that we were in total spiritual warfare. And as I said, his Christian witness has gone around the world now, these 32 years, and of course that's what's helped keep us going as a family. This situation today, Dr. Stan, I keep wondering, we've tried so hard, like you, for so many years to get the truth and the information out to people, and how can they keep letting their and that sons and daughters now, of course, in the military, just keep going to the slaughter like this? I mean, you would think by now they would, as you said, they just will not look back on history, will they?
Well, the thing is that when the draft is reinstated, and it's their son or their daughter who's being sent off to be slaughtered or crippled for life, at that point they get concerned. Initially, they'll be very patriotic. And I love this country. I've given my life for this country, but it's not. I certainly oppose those people who've taken control of our government by gaining control of the media and the leadership of both political parties. In fact, I would be less of an American not to speak out. The trouble is, you'd be amazed how many people here will support us, but they'll say, please don't put our names on your mailing list.
Yes.
We don't want anybody to know that we do support you. And I say that, a coward dies a thousand deaths. You've got to be willing to stand up, as your son did, for what he believes in.
I am so tired of cowards. I really have to say it. I really, really am. Dr. Stan, my husband, of course, went out and enlisted in World War II at the age of 17 and went through every major naval battle in the Pacific and ended up with his ship. Well, he was one of six survivors when his ship was hit the first time. And then he ended up the second time on a ship that docked in Japan when the bomb was dropped. And he's been one of the few survivors of the cancer because of not having protection from the radiation. And, of course, he is the cancer victim today. And, as I said, he's just been one of the luckier ones. He's survived longer. We could not even get a hearing aid for him from the only thing we have ever asked for. We've not asked for anything from anybody. He did ask the VA for a hearing aid and couldn't get it.
Well, I would not hold my breath to get something from the VA.
Oh, no.
The whole purpose of the VA is to keep the veterans in line and to keep them from making too much of a fuss, to give them the idea that, well, maybe next month or next year or a few years from now you're going to get some compensation for what we did to you, the experiments we carried out on you, the radiation experiments, the vaccine experiments, the drug experiments that we carried out on you. But, of course, we don't want you ever to tell the public about that.
If I could just digress just a little bit, and on that very subject, I was a representative for the Gulf War Veterans Association when I was living in Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
And this has been about 6-7 years ago, and I was at the VA there for Captain George Riley getting the information to the Gulf War veterans at that time on the very things that you just mentioned. A friend and I were there trying to give out information like that, and they sent up a security guard and took this old gray-haired grandmother and my little friend out for interfering with the confidentiality of the veterans.
Now, who are you talking to? Were you talking to the veterans or what?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Gulf War veterans. Right. Getting information to them on how they could get help and just simply observing and getting the information on how they were being treated and not being told the truth.
And they were used as guinea pigs for experimental vaccines. That's
absolutely
why the government is suppressing all their vaccine records.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why over a third of them already received disability. Of course, they get maybe 10 or 15%. And another third of them, almost a third of them, are ill. They haven't been able to get anything at all. They were simply guinea pigs. And a macabre experiment. And the tragedy is their lives are shattered. Many of them, a significant number, have died. The government will admit 11,000, and Dr. Garth Nicholson says it's closer to 30,000 of these otherwise healthy young men who should have lived 3 score and 7 years, or 3 score and 10 years. They're dying, and in increasing numbers.
Now we have thousands more going through the same thing.
Right, and many of them, of course, will never be the same again. They're getting, of course, exposed to excessive amounts of depleted uranium, and this has just come out in the last day or two. They've been testing the boys coming home from Iraq, and I think about 80% of them have been exposed to depleted uranium with a half-life of 4 billion years.
It's genocide on our civilization.
Well, did you like to give that address out just one more time?
Sure. Thank you. You can order the book from George Coey, C-O-E-Y. Address is 6555 U.S. Highway 68 South, Apartment E-14. Town is two words, West Liberty, and that's Ohio, 43357. $20 includes postage.
No, guys, just hang on. We'll be right back. We've got just 3 minutes to wrap up the program in. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Mrs. Coey. Her son, John Allen Coey, died in Rhodesia in 1975. The book is A Martyr Speaks, the Journal of the Late John Allen Coey, an idealistic young man who thought that perhaps by fighting in Rhodesia he could stem the tide of this conspiracy, not recognizing the conspiracy is right here in America. Well, how do we have an impact? Well, the greatest weapon we have of all is the truth. And so we have the opportunity to speak 5 days, 5 hours every day on the radio, and to reach people across the United States by shortwave, by internet, by radio, by satellite. We just need you to help us get other people to listen. Ms. Coey, what message would you like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, Dr. Stan, I'd like to quote from the dedication that John, the very first page of his journal, he wrote this: to the 100,000 American dead of Korea and Vietnam who were betrayed by their own government, to those who have sought meaning and purpose in life and truth in an age of deceit, deception, and conspiracy. Remember the fundamental truth of Jesus Christ. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father except by me. And I would like to explain the title of the book. The first publisher chose the title, since John had not selected one. And so they chose A Martyr Speak because of martyr in the Greek, meaning witness, and John was a witness for both spiritual and political truth.
Amen to that. Well, I appreciate so much your having written the book and really kept his memory alive, because I think it's so important, especially in times like this when we've engaged now in World War III and the average American doesn't even understand what's happening. And let's hope that his message and his courage will have some impact on some of the people listening to this program tonight out across America.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and I want to encourage your listeners and your people, the people out there, to support you in your efforts and your books and the magnificent information that you're getting out all the time. And I do try to let other people know and to get them to listen. And I just thank you so very much for the opportunity on behalf of my son and my husband and I.
God bless you. Thank you so much, Ms. Coey.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program tonight. I think it's important that you understand there are young people who really believe and who are willing to give their lives in this battle. But this is a spiritual battle. We're fighting on a political and ideological and cultural and educational and financial battlefield. And we have to understand where the enemy is and how best to fight him. Can we fight him with weapons? Not at the present time. But we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course the weapons that we have to have is faith in our Lord, and our job is to do our best, but the battle is the Lord's, and the results will be in the Lord's. Our job is to try to reach as many people as we can and get them thinking about what's going on, understanding we are engaged in a battle against organized evil, and Lucifer is claiming as many souls as he can for eternity. And I believe we are heading into a cataclysmic war, and the average American has no knowledge. Oh, the economy is looking good. The employment figures are up. Look what happened to the stock market over this last few days. But all of this is manipulated. It's all perception. It has very little to do with reality. And remember, as we open our program by saying reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And that is what happens as when they control the media, they control how you think. And years ago, when I was first getting started, I found it difficult to believe the media was controlled. But all you need to do is go from one network to the other. They're all basically talking about the same issues and ignoring the same issues. And so many of the really important things going on in the world today, you will never hear mentioned. And that's why you need to listen to programs like this. And you need to help us, if you believe in what we say and what we stand for, you need to help us get this information out. Now, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. So if you agree there's a problem and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then if you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, our March newsletter tells you what happened at the secret cabinet meetings in the White House in the opening months of the year 2001 in January and February, 8 to 9 months before the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. What they were talking about there, and of course we simply quote from the book by Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, who attended those meetings. You'll be surprised at what you read, especially as you see what's happening in Iraq today. So if you'd like to get a free copy of that newsletter, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. As you know, we're on the air 5 hours every day. You can listen to our radio programs on the Internet 5 hours a day and not get much of anything accomplished. You can listen to the archives that are there. And if you listen 5 hours a day and listen to the archives, why you're in real trouble. But you'll get the programs we do. Some of them are repetitive. We'll have the same guest on several programs. But if they're important guests, we want you to get their message. And then we want you to help us get that message out across the United States. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. If you cannot afford to subscribe to our newsletter, why, you can pull it down. It'll be posted up there on the Internet at radioliberty.com in about a week or 10 days, and so you'll be able to pull down this month's newsletter and all the other newsletters that are there. Please pull them down, copy them, circulate them, get them to other people. Try to get them to think about what's going on and to understand the significance of what is taking place in America and throughout the world today as we move into World War III. So we hope that you'll tell others about our website. We hope that you'll tell others about our radio program and encourage them to join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. Well, we also ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but we ask you to pray for revival, because if America does not turn back to our Lord, why, we will never again have a blessed nation. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line right now Rodney Stitz. Hi, Rodney. How are you doing?
Yes, good evening, Stan.
Well, Rodney worked for the FAA as he was an airline pilot for many years, and then he worked for the FAA as was it a crash investigator, or what would you call it?
Well, I was a safety investigator. My job would included conducting flight checks of airline pilots, issuing ratings, getting involved in aircraft incidents and accidents, making recommendations, looking for safety problems, and making recommendations to prevent some of the problems from developing into crashes.
All right. Now, of course, you had recognized long ago the susceptibility of our airlines to hijacking, hadn't you?
Well, that was one of the things that years ago I made many recommendations, but among them was the need to take preventative measures on hijackings. And, of course, they've been going on for about 50 years. And it was really very easy, very inexpensive, and the necessary preventative measures could have been implemented within 24 hours. And it was so easy to prevent them. And, of course, what I discovered is extremely serious problems within the certain offices of the FAA. And these are the same problems that created the conditions that enabled hijackers to seize four airliners. And this is an area that has yet to be exposed. Because if they go into that area, then you open up a can of worms that almost is limitless.
Well, now, how would you have prevented the hijackings if you had been in charge?
Well, okay, let's say the FAA was functioning normally, and again, as I said before, there was very serious misconduct in the FAA. But anyhow, if the FAA had done what would have ordered, the two main things, and they were very simple. One, remove all keys from the flight attendants. Anybody, any male, it doesn't even need a weapon, can seize the keys to the cockpit. And so if they don't have any keys, there's no way they're going to take over the aircraft. And then the second thing that I recommended was to keep the cockpit door closed during the entire flight when there's passengers are on board. And there are some other things, but those were the two major ones. But if those had been taken, 9/11 could not have happened because the hijackers could not have gotten into the cockpit. And all it would have been was a newspaper, a smaller newspaper headline the following day. But now, if we were to recognize this, and why people can't recognize it, I don't know. I've been in aviation over 60 years, so maybe it's more obvious to me. But if people would recognize it...
Hold that thought right there, Rodney. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitz, and Rodney is saying that if they had simply taken the keys away from everybody, so the only people who had the keys to the cockpit were the pilots, and then, of course, you had kept the door locked at any time, this would have prevented the hijacking of the planes. Now, what about the doors? I understand that the doors really were rather weak and flimsy in certain cases and needed to be reinforced.
Well, that was one of the recommendations I made, and the airlines knew this also. So, let's say if I'm a pilot and someone's trying to break down that door, now it's not that easy. It can be broken down. But let's say someone's banging on it. We can very well put the aircraft into an unusual attitude where they're not going to be doing any more banging on the doors. But let me go into so many misconduct that arose from this, because the misconduct in the FAA was only part of the problem. First of all, what did I do? Well, first of all, when I was in the FAA, I was in the Los Angeles area, and the FAA came to me and said, look, Rod, we have a very serious problem, and without going into details, they gave me the assignment to correct the conditions that were at that time causing the worst series of aviation disasters in the nation's history. So anyhow, I took the assignment, and it didn't take me long to find out the problem. So it was so serious, and trying to correct it, the standard practice in the government is to stonewall anybody trying to do it. So anyhow, I used the law in a very unusual manner to where I became an independent counsel, and I conducted a hearing. It took about 6 months. Nothing like this has ever occurred before in the FAA or probably any other government agency. But anyhow, I'm conducting this hearing. The hearing officer is a member of the administrative staff. I'm bringing in management. I'm getting their testimony. I'm getting additional documents that prove that supported my charges of the misconduct and related air disasters. Well, matter of fact, during the hearing, there was two other major air disasters right in my immediate area of responsibility due to these things. But anyhow, I'm making reports to the Department of Justice. I'm making reports to the National Transportation Safety Board. I'm going to a federal grand jury in Denver after the Justice Department covered up. So anyhow, finally I thought, well, hell with this. I'm leaving.
Hold your thoughts there for just a minute. We're going to bring our other stations on board, and then we'll be right back here with Rodney Stitz. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitz, and we're talking about his experience as an FAA flight examiner. And so pick up the story from there, Rodney.
Okay, so what I did, I left government, and just and incidentally, I put some strong warnings in my final report, which incidentally, that report is on my website at defraudingamerica.com. Anyhow, I left government, and the corruption, of course, continues, and the crashes continued. So I figured, well, I've got all this information, I should do something with it. So first thing I did, again using the law in a creative manner, I filed the first of several lawsuits against the FAA and against the NTSB for the cover-ups in the U.S. District Courts in San Francisco. Well, the first two lawsuits, the district and also the appellate judges, when I was arguing before the appellate court, admitted, Mr. Stitz, these are really serious charges, but it's up to members of Congress to address these. Well, true, but it's also the responsibility of federal judges under a statute that maybe no one's ever used but myself, and this is Title 18 U.S.C. Section 4. It makes it a crime. If anybody knows of a federal offense, federal crime, and doesn't promptly report it to a federal judge or other federal officer. So I thought, well, hey, I can circumvent the congressional cover-up, the Justice Department cover-up, and go to a federal judge. And then, of course, the Justice Department, you know, the same one that went after Martha Stewart for obstruction of justice, Well, the Justice Department lawyers, and every time I filed, they filed a motion to block me from reporting these things. And then the federal judges then dismissed it, which they should not have had, because this is obstruction of justice on their part. They don't have the right to block me or anybody else from reporting federal offenses. But anyhow, conditions continued, and finally I figured, well, I know the public wants to know about these things. I'll do something to get to the public. So I started publishing books. The first one was in 1978, first edition of Unfriendly Skies. Now, since then, I've been on over 3,000 radio and television shows bringing this information out. Well, over a period of time, other government agents who were familiar with corruption in other areas, including drug smuggling and things like this, they came to me and started providing me with insider information and documentation. So anyhow, I eventually started in 1986, started filing actions again to expose, like, the CIA drug smuggling, things like that, and which are described in my book. Well, what the judges did, first, they always dismissed the actions where I couldn't produce the evidence, but then they came out with orders, which exist to this day, that permanently bars me from federal district or appellate courts. And in other words, I have no civil rights anymore. If anybody does anything to me, I can't even file to defend myself. You might think this is somewhat unconstitutional and unlawful, but in which it is. So anyhow, as I'm finding out more of these things, I'm finding out about, from insiders, mind you. This is no conspiracy stuff. This is from insiders who are describing to me, like, for instance, the suitcase nuclear devices that were being smuggled out of the Soviet Union through Lithuania. They were giving me information about moles and the FBI and the CIA. This is before the moles were discovered, and other things like that. So I'm now filing other actions. And the last action I filed before 9/11 was in the U.S. District Court in Reno. And I was trying to expose, among other things, the problems in the FAA that were responsible for some of these preventable air disasters. Well, they again blocked me there. They refused to receive the evidence. Matter of fact, they even ordered me to pay several $1,000 sanctions for doing it. So anyhow, 9/11 occurs. Now we really got a problem. So I filed a federal lawsuit in U.S. District Court in New York, where most of the 9/11 litigation is occurring, and where, incidentally, the U.S. attorney charged Martha Stewart with obstruction of justice. Anyhow, they have to quote, file that when they get it. Instead, for 13 months, they blocked that being filed. Finally, it wasn't filed until I had sent the letters to the justices of the Supreme Court complaining about it. Well, they filed it, but on the same day they filed it, Judge Mukasey, M-U-K-A-S-E-Y, he filed a 5-page sua sponte dismissal order, dismissing the action the moment it's been filed. And he had to be working on that for several weeks because there was a lot of material in that. So he's preparing a dismissal order before he even files my complaint. So I promptly filed a notice of appeal. There's an appeal schedule put up. I had my appeal brief in on by January 12th. But the U.S. attorney, and again, that's the one charging Martha Stewart with obstruction of justice, they have refused to file their brief, and their brief was due on February the 12th. Well, now it's April, and they still haven't filed it. Well, he called me today from the U.S. Attorney's office and asked if it would be okay if they filed it in a month from now. I said, yeah, that's okay. So anyhow, they got a problem. If they can either continue the cover-up that made 9/11 possible, or they can finally address it. And if they ever address that, then we get into scandals that are almost incomprehensible.
All right, now, Rodney, first of all, you actually were advising them that they could hijack these planes very readily, and you told them what could be done in the way of certainly taking the keys away from everybody, reinforcing the doors, keeping the doors locked at all times, and this really would have solved most of the problem, and they refused to do anything. How long ago were you making those recommendations?
Oh, that was... my whole time with the FAA, I'm making recommendations on obvious safety problems. Some of them were safety violations. Some of them were criminal violations. You know, there are, when a government agent is being lied to, that's a crime under 18 U.S.C. Section 201. That's what they got Martha Stewart on. She allegedly fed to him. Well, like United Airlines, and United plays a big role in all this.
That was, of course, the unfriendly skies that was takeoff
right.
of their slogan, the friendly skies.
United was falsifying records to cover up for their failure to provide crew training. And crew training is the most important thing, really. And I was able to identify numerous criminal activities. Now, one of the reasons they asked me to take over this problem assignment, there was one of the disasters was a United Airlines jet that crashed into Brooklyn, New York, about a mile from where the World Trade Center was later built. Well, the same corruption, both at United Airlines and in the FAA, that was responsible for that. And that was the world's worst air disaster at that time, which was in my immediate area of responsibility. The same culture in the FAA is what made 9/11 possible. And there's all types of really bizarre things if you get into this. But one of the things that it would help bring out, those that are disturbed about the corruption in the federal courts, the judicial records show time and time again where federal district and appellate judges blocked me from reporting these criminal activities that I, as a former federal agent and witness, had discovered. And they don't have the right to do that. They must receive the reports. What they do with it after they get it, that's something else. But so that's prima facie a criminal act. So here we have, and again, I'm not talking about conspiracy theories, I'm talking about facts. So here we have a series of federal judges blocking these reports, committing a criminal act, and then some of the things I was trying to expose had been resulted in 9/11. Now, some of the other things, are, like right now, the 9/11 Commission, they're also blocking this. I forced declarations into their record, which they won't even acknowledge. And what they're doing, they focus on intelligence failures. Well, intelligence, that's a typical controlled investigation where we focus on something that, well, it's not very nice, but it's at least not criminal. I mean, I've been documenting this from the days of the October surprise and other things, or CIA drug smuggling. They don't focus by having a controlled investigation. They bypass this, and that's what the 9/11 Commission is doing. They are focusing on, well, look at it this way. I have a bank. I put all the money in an unlocked room, figuring I'm going to count on somebody telling me when there's going to be a holdup. Well, that's the same like with the FAA. They knew how to prevent these things. They had numerous reports for the last 4 or 5 years that terrorists were planning on using aircraft, hijacking aircraft. In 24 hours, if they had a competent FAA administrator instead of someone that's a vote getter, they could have put those orders into effect that no keys in the cockpit, that cockpit door stayed closed. 3,000 people wouldn't be dead today. We wouldn't see invading Iraq.
Hold that thought right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Rodney Stitch, former FAA inspector. And we're talking about the things that could have been done that they were, you know, you mentioned before we went to the break that over the five or six years before the hijacking, the 911 hijacking, the government was getting reports of hijacking planes to use them as missiles. Certainly we know about what had happened with Project Bajica over in the Philippines. And do you know of any other instances where the government had prior knowledge that they were going to hijack planes and use them as weapons?
Yes, a terrorist took over an Air France plane, I think it was an ATA airliner, but it was a French airliner, and they hijacked it, and then the pilot said, hey, we got to land. Before we get to Paris, we've got to land and get some fuel. Well, when they landed, then the hijackers were ground forces took over.
But that was
the hijackers admitted they were going to fly the plane into a major structure in Paris.
They were going to get the Eiffel Tower, is what they're going to do.
Yes. Now, also, I have books on the internet. The one is Terrorism Against America, and in this, I describe numerous reports of using airplanes to fly them into buildings. And there were even studies done, and I give the details of the studies by government insiders that made reports that this would be done.
All right. Now, whereabouts in the Internet is that report?
Okay, that's in the book, Terrorism Against America.
Terrorism Against America? Is it up on the web, or is the book...
Yes. Now, what they do, and it's only $12 to download it, and you can download it in either Word or Adobe PDF, and it's about, I think it's about 600 pages. So there's a lot of material in there that the average person hasn't heard about, but these... You know, I have so many insiders, and they provide me with this information.
Now, is it available in book form or just on the Internet?
Terrorism Against America, and then another one I have, Blowback, 9/11, Iraq, Lies, and Cover-Ups. Those two are only as an e-book on the Internet, so they have to be downloaded. But for $12, you're not out very much. Now, the other books, like Unfriendly Skies, while it doesn't have 9/11 in it, it gives you all the details to see the deep-seated misconduct in the FAA that made 9/11 possible, because it gives you years after years of examples, and again, I lived through that.
And, of course, we carry the Unfriendly Skies book, we carry Rodney's book, The Drugging of America, and his book, The Defrauding of America. So if you're interested in getting those excellent books, and I think, of course, The Drugging of America is so important, the documentation of the fact that the CIA has been involved in drug smuggling for years. In fact, even my and Michael Rupert's website, they have a link to the CIA website where the GAO, or the Inspector General, had admitted that the CIA was involved with drug smuggling. But the average American has never been allowed to know that because, of course, that would be just so impossible. After all, we have a war on drugs. Well, we had a war on drugs, and we get more drugs all the time. We have a war on cancer. We have more cancer. We have a war on poverty. We got more poverty. We got a war on terrorism, and we never tried to get Osama bin Laden. I wonder what these wars are really about. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Rodney Stitch. Rodney, just go ahead and pick up your story from there.
Well, if people would, if only enough people would read about these things and then start showing some indication of outrage, there's a lot of things that can be addressed that's very harmful to the American people. You know, we have a lot of people in prison that have been framed, set up, and what have you. Some of those people could be helped. But there's so many things. It's kind of a Trojan horse type of subverting U.S. interest. The thing that disturbs me is also, besides the misconduct in government, and of course the lying by the Bush administration, is unprecedented. But equally serious is the cover-up, the support by so much of the media for the lies that got us into this mess in Iraq. And the young people, they've got several decades of misery again in front of them. You know, I was in the Navy a year before Pearl Harbor, and all the evidence we had of the war coming, we were, as usual, asleep. Well, the same thing's been happening, and the same thing happened in 9/11. It seemed to be a deep-seated culture in the United States, and I don't know what it's going to take to correct these things, but I'm not optimistic.
Well, were you a naval flyer at the time, or were you just the regular Navy?
I was in the Navy. I was a crew member at first in the Navy, and then I, after Pearl Harbor, then I went to pilot training, and then I was actually the youngest patrol plane commander the Navy ever had. Bush says, well, Bush and I got our Navy wings about the same time, but Bush says he was the youngest Navy pilot. Well, he may have been the youngest single-engine pilot, but I was the youngest patrol plane commander, because at the age of 21, I had been a PBY flight instructor. I was a liberator and privateer, patrol plane commander. So I started young. And then, you know, another interesting thing, after the war, I was an international airline pilot, and I flew in the Middle East quite a bit. I flew into and out of Baghdad, Jerusalem, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and I lived with the people. I drank and ate with them. I flew Muslim pilgrims to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. So I had, and then I visited the refugee camps, which was rather very sad. So I got to have a fairly good understanding of problems over there, which, of course, those are the problems that started all of the terrorism. And we don't seem to want to address, hey, why are they so mad at us? Well, of course, since Iraq, of course, we know why they're mad at us. But why were they mad at us before? And until they address this, which no politician has the courage to do, it's going to continue to get worse.
Well, I fear that you're absolutely right. And the problem is that with the war in Iraq, we are mobilizing the whole Arab world against the United States. And this is exactly what Samuel Huntington said in his book, The Clash of Civilization, published in 1996. And he said the worst thing that you could do would be to go into another culture, and he was giving the Muslim world as an example, and try to force your views upon them, and even worse, to get involved with a war with any of those countries, because then all the other countries are going to come to their defense because of the kindred relationship, the common culture, the common religious faith. And that's how you can get a Third World War started. His book is prophetic, and we're doing everything he told us not to do, or maybe we're doing exactly what they wanted us to do.
You know, like you said, at any time there can be a misstep and we get a missile war. But look at the lying of about Iraq had a nuclear missile program. They were producing chemical, biological weapons. They were importing raw uranium. They had weapons to fly these to the United States. The aircraft they were talking about was a amateur kind of a balsa wood plane that wouldn't get from one side of Iraq to the other. That's what they were saying could reach our shore at any time.
But you know, they showed that on television. The American people saw it, and they said, "Well, it must endanger New York because they wouldn't lie to us, would they?"
Well, you know, I hate to say, there was a time when I thought, well, government wouldn't lie. But then I used to believe in the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, too. So you've got to excuse me.
We'll be back in just a moment with Rodney Stitch. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Rodney Stitch, and we're talking, well, about his books, The Unfriendly Skies, The Drugging of America, The Defrauding of America, a couple of books he's got up on the Internet, Terrorism in America and Blowback on 9/11, and so we'll have to look those up. What are the websites where we can find those, Rodney?
They would be at the defraudingamerica.com website, and the order page has quite a bit of information on that.
And what do? You just put in your Visa card, MasterCard, or what?
Right. Just order it, and you download it right then and there.
All right, fine. So that's Terrorism in America. And you really have a number of references to the fact that the government... I have a number of references as well. I just want to see if you have some that I don't have, going into the fact that we know the government knew that they were going to hijack planes and crash them into our buildings. In fact, I have an article that Bill Gertz wrote, and it was published 2 months before the attack, and it was published and published... on an email that we have used had to do with United Airlines stewardesses. And he gave the whole story of Project Pachinko, hijacking planes, crashing them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the White House, the Sears Tower, and the in Chicago, the Transamerica building in San Francisco. Bill Gertz wrote that article. It was published 2 months before 9/11, and somebody, for some reason, got to Bill Gertz, the only thing I can imagine, because he doesn't even remember writing the article. And yet I have a copy of it. And when I told him what was in it, he said, oh, that's all wrong. That's not what I wrote at all. And yet we have the article. We have other articles out of the Washington Times that say exactly the same thing. So it's amazing how a competent writer can forget about what he wrote. Or maybe frightened to death the American people would know that they knew ahead of time that they were going to take planes and crash them into the World Trade Center. Because how could you possibly justify knowing that and then doing nothing? Why that would mean that people in our government were guilty of mass murder.
Well, you know, going back a little way to the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, an interesting thing, and this is in a couple of my books, Drugging America, for one. In 1992, a year before the bombing, a key government agent was targeting the terrorist group in Jersey City. Incidentally, that's where I went to high school. But anyhow, he was targeting them because he was targeting their drug operation that was generating money for their terrorist operation.
Rodney, just hold that thought for just a moment when we bring our stations back on. Well, I guess it's Rodney Stitch, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Incidentally, if any of our listeners would like to see a copy of that email that was put out 2 months before 9/11 by Bill Gertz, published for the United Airlines stewardesses, we'd be glad to send that to you. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or pardon me, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and just ask for a free copy of that article. We'll send it to you. So it was well known. I got this off the web immediately after 9/11. Of course, shortly after that, it was pulled down, never to be seen again. And Bill Gertz just doesn't remember writing it for some reason. But anyway, go ahead and tell the story there, Rodney.
Well, as you remember, Youssef was one of the terrorists.
Ramsey Youssef,
Jersey
right.
City group. Well, he was one of the ones that this federal agent was targeting. Well, pressure was put on the Justice Department from several sources. So what the Justice Department did, they charged the head of this group with criminally violating the constitutional rights of one of the suspected drug traffickers. So, and this something like this had never happened before. So they sent him to prison. He actually ended up in prison.
Now, this was one
and
of
that,
the...
of course, stopped all the investigation into this terrorist group in New Jersey. So,
now, what was the man's name? Do you recall offhand?
I'm sorry?
What was the man's name?
That was, Oh, God. Let me think. You know, there's so many things in my different books. Sometimes I have to look at them to refresh my mind. But it's in my Drugging America
book. It's in Drugging America. And so he was actually sent to prison because he was... Was he investigating Ramzi Yousef?
Well, he was investigating Yousef and other drug traffickers in the New York, New Jersey area. And they were operating, some of them were operating out of bodegas there. So anyhow, he ended up in prison. That stopped the investigation. And, of course, it sends a message to other government agents, just like when they gave me a lot of pressure in the FAA to be keep quiet. So all the other inspectors then kept quiet. So anyhow, he'd still be in prison, but the first George Bush pardoned him before he left office. But it sends a message. So this is what we call, I think they call it the butterfly effect. And you've got something occurring, and way down the line, as a result of that, you get catastrophic consequences. So here we have Yousef. He gets away. He's planning to put bombs on 11 U.S. airliners in the Far East. And he's also was planning on hijacking aircraft and flying them into buildings, which you made reference to earlier. And this was discovered by Philippine authorities and conveyed to our illustrious White House politicians and our intelligence agents. So I can't say too much for the operation of our government.
Well, obviously they had to cover up the information that they knew ahead of time that they were planning on hijacking our planes and using them as weapons, because if they had known that, then how could they justify forbidding our pilots to carry weapons, you're using your technique of reinforcing the doors of the cockpit and keeping them locked at all the time and taking the keys away so nobody could possibly get into the closet, into the cockpit? How could they justify not having marshals on the planes, or, they could always put National Guardsmen on the plane, temporarily armed National Guardsmen? That certainly would have been a deterrent to the hijackers.
Yeah,
but we did none of the things that were logical.
Right. Well, you know, when I was flying in the Middle East, and my airline, we were flying all over the world, so I had a pistol with me, just in case. But just those things that I mentioned, no keys in the cockpit, that would have prevented this. And all these people would not be dead today. And it's so obvious, and it boggles my mind that people aren't addressing that. But if they were to address it, there's a mile-long paper trail that I left in the offices of many members of Congress. I was reporting to members of Congress the missiles being acquired by terrorists. I reported this about 5 months before TWA 800 went down. Yeah, even responding. I sent it to every member of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee.
Now, these were shoulder held Stinger missiles.
Yeah, and then I also reported to them that my source, who was telling me about the suitcase nuclear bombs being smuggled out of the Soviet Union through Lithuania. And I'm surprised one of those hasn't gone off yet. But hang on, folks. I'm sure it's going to happen. And you can blame some of the things going on in our government for it. And then there were other things, just like when I was finding out about we had spies in the CIA and FBI. This was about a year and a half before they were finally discovered.
Before they found Hansen, though?
Nobody listened. Nobody responded.
But there were people there in the government who knew this and let you know that there were spies there.
Oh, well, I was getting this information. Well, part of this information on the suitcase nuclear bombs were conveyed to me by this fellow had a company where he was training Lithuanian and Russian police personnel in counterterrorism measures. So he got their confidence, and he was finding out about these things. And so He was trying to give the information to the Department of Defense. The FBI insisted on being there, and he refused because he didn't trust the FBI, because he knew the FBI had Soviet mold in there. So anyhow, then the FBI filed false charges against him, and which is a normal procedure. But this is why, I mean, we're so far, the culture, the lying, and the lack of questioning by the average American, we've got serious problems. I don't know if they'll ever be corrected.
Well, let's go to Herman. He's calling in from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Very good. Another interesting program. But, you know, I have a question for our guest. Here you have a company like Boeing that's been in the business of building airplanes for decades. People don't spend a few thousand buying one of these planes, like a 747. They spend tens of millions of dollars. Now, why don't the aircraft manufacturers themselves, when they're designing these things, I mean, how much more would it cost them to do a really great security job on the cockpit entrance? Why aren't they doing this?
What you mentioned, they knew this all along. Like, for instance, a friend of mine was a United Airlines DC-8 flight instructor. He was telling me that at one of their meetings, that management was referring to the lightweight door, how easy they could be broken down. So they knew about these things, just like the manufacturers and the airlines knew that when they didn't have smoke detectors in certain cargo compartments, that was a hazard. That's how Air Florida happened to go down. But why wouldn't they do it? They know the dangers there. But this is one of the things I discovered when I became an air safety investigator, is these obvious things happen all the time, and the average person, if they knew about it, would have difficulty comprehending it.
Well, is it because it's driven by trying to produce it at the cheapest possible cost?
Well, that's probably definitely involved. But just like you said, you know it's dangerous. How much more would it cost to make the door a little stronger? Or how much more would it cost to put the smoke detectors and the fire agent in that cargo compartment? It wouldn't cost that much.
Well, have you ever asked any of the management directly of Boeing or any of the other companies?
Well, I wasn't assigned to Boeing. I had more direct problems facing me. I mean, not fair. People that would be working with Boeing should have asked that. But the thing is, here's what: say you're an inspector, or I'm an inspector, and we raise these things, they're going to tell you shut up. And if you don't shut up, if you make reports like I did, and the reports, those are official reports, they're removed and destroyed. That's a criminal act, and especially when people die as a result of it. But this is why, you know, it took a lot for me to become an independent prosecutor in the FAA and destroy my career. It took a lot. In other words, you had to be really angry to spend your life filing lawsuits trying to expose this crud. Because it's not an easy job, believe me. And if I had better sense, I would never have started it.
But you got started and you've done what was right, and I admire you for it. Anything else, Herman?
Well, again, I haven't heard the whole program, but obviously you have a great deal of courage. Has your life ever been threatened?
Well, if you read my books, you'll see what they did to me. And, you know, if you see what they did to me to silence me and then bring it forward to 9/11, it's really a pathetic story. Because, I mean, they, first of all, when they issued orders barring me from federal court access, and then I'm discovering other crimes like CIA drug trafficking, so I file an action. Well, in Sacramento, the U.S. attorney, Levi, who's now a judge, he charged me with criminal contempt of court. At the age of about 65, I was 6 months in federal prison, including 2 months in solitary confinement. Now, try that. And then when you're in there, now, I had a lot of assets. I had about $10 million in assets, and that's government records. they seized all of that without any notice, without reason, and then they issued orders barring me from filing objections. When I filed objections, they charged me with criminal contempt of court again. I mean, that's some of the stuff. And when this happens to you over a period of years, believe me, your life is hell. I'm 81 now, so they can't do much more to me anymore.
Do you believe there's any hope when we have an attorney general in Washington who is an avowed Christian and holds Bible studies at his offices?
Well, I know that's a fair question. I would wish we had an attorney general who really was a Christian, who would do what the right thing was for our country rather than what is politically expedient.
I try to keep. Well, remember, George Bush is about Christian. I think he's the biggest liar we've ever had in government. Look at what Nixon. He just fibbed on something that he learned after the fact. They impeached him. But here with Bush, all of these bald-faced lies, and they were lies. Nobody uses the word lies, but they were lies. He knew the evidence existed before he said them, that they were lies. And look, we got several thousand Iraqis that were killed. We got little babies with their legs blown off. We got GIs. We've got worldwide terrorism now against us, and he's not being impeached. Matter of fact, most of the Republicans support him. So that's where I see he's becoming a Republican.
Well, anything else you want to say, Herman?
Well, this final question. If we ever had a huge disaster in this country where a big bomb, radiological or otherwise, were to go off, do you think the people might finally wake up and say...
I don't think they ever will. Well, I'm not totally blaming them because there's so much disinformation. And in some of my books, and there's been other books written about it, how the CIA has a lot of the media personnel on their payroll. So we got that to start with. And then there's some people they're constantly in denial. It takes a little effort also to show outrage, and some of them just aren't mentally capable of addressing these things. So I'm not optimistic at all. But
at 81,
I don't have to worry about it much longer.
All right. Thanks as much for calling, Herman.
Yeah, thank you.
And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got a few more minutes if you have a question or comment. Rodney Stitch has been on the front line of this battle for a long time. He's a dedicated patriot. He's done what was right at a tremendous personal cost to him and his family. But this is what you have to do. And I certainly admire him for being willing to speak out. Of course, the time he was in prison, he got the chance to speak to many people who had been put there on trumped-up charges. Isn't that true, Rodney? Many of these are CIA and FBI officials who tried to tell the truth?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, you know, it kind of blew back on him because this is where I started meeting all the CIA guys. And Gunter Reusbacher was one of the first ones, and, here's some of the information I get. Now, very few of the American public know about what went on in Boston with the FBI agents, and that went all the way to Hoover for about over 20 years.
Oh, you mean Whitey Bulger, when we were actually covering for this murderer and torturer?
Oh, yes, yes.
The FBI was
And here's another thing. One of my sources was in the New York mafia family, and he says, "Well, hellas, that's the same thing we were doing in New York." So he was giving me information on it. So I write to the commission that's investigating it, and they just released two great big manuals on what they found about the corruption in the FBI. But they weren't even interested in getting my information showing that this wasn't only in Boston. It was in New York also, and it's probably in other places.
It's all across America. We have a book called Dangerous Deception. It's the story of Whitey Bulger, who for over 20 years was covered by the FBI as he murdered over 20 people and tortured them to death. And when the local police tried to do anything, the FBI would tip them off.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if the public knew this, but most of the public doesn't. Well, first of all, the media kept a lid on this, except in the Boston area. So can you imagine the media keeping secret the fact that FBI agents with J. Edgar Hoover's knowledge were giving murderers the names of government informants, knowing they would be murdered and were murdered? When you've got a group like that, how do you expect them to protect the United States against terrorists?
Well, we got a real problem. The book is Dangerous Deception. It's the story that that Rodney is telling. Do you tell that story in any of your books?
Oh yes, that's in my e-book. I go into details on
in
that,
in
and
your
I
e-book.
Give you the names of people, and also the relationship between that individual and Youssef when they were in prison.
Now, which book is that? Now,
that's
is that Blowback?
Terrorism Against America, and also in the Blowback book.
Okay, hold back. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is, I was going to say Ramsey Osen, it's Rodney Sitz. And, of course, you can go to his website, defraudingamerica.com. Is that right?
That's right.
And you'll find these two books, and one, of course, has to do with Blowback. It's called Blowback 911. The other is Terrorism Against America. They're e-books. And if they're as good as his other books, I recommend them to you. We do carry three of his books, Unfriendly Size, Defrauding America, and the last one is Drugging America. And it's about time the American people understood the biggest drug smuggler in the United States is why our own Central Intelligence Agency, headed at one time by a man named George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency back in the 1970s. But then, of course, we have short memories. We really don't like to think about things like that. But why should we be surprised? You go back to the origin of the Skull and Bone Society back in 1832. Skull and Bones was organized by the Russell family, who were involved in the opium traffic in China. What goes around comes around. Well, Rodney, what message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening, and would you like to get your websites out there?
Well, I guess the main thing is to let people know that there's grave, grave problems ahead, and we've got to get the liars out of government. But first thing we got to do is the public has to start learning about these things. The information's there, and this is what I've tried to do, bring it together, both the insider information and also information from other sources that is not generally available. But this will certainly give you a different perspective on, as Bush says, the terrorists hate us because we're so good. Jesus Christ, I could just about erp on that one.
All right, Rodney. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. I appreciate it, and God bless you. And we'll just be talking to you again here in the next few days on a couple of our other programs.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
Good night, Rodney. Okay, and that's Rodney Sitz. He's 81 years old. He's a real crusader for righteousness. He's given his life in this battle to try to get the information out through the American people, through his books and through his radio shows. Done over 3,000 radio shows. If you haven't heard Rodney before, why, he's a colorful character. We hope that you will be interested in getting his books, or maybe you want to get our information on CIA and drugs, books such as Barry and the Boys, the story of Barry Seal, who worked very closely with George Herbert Walker Bush. He made almost $1 billion in drug smuggling. The Boys, why the Boys were the CIA that Barry Seal worked with. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course we're talking about the book Barry and the Boys. It's one of the books that we carry. We think it's an important book. It's the story of the CIA drug smuggling operation which Barry Seal was part of. But as so often happens, those who work with the CIA eventually are themselves assassinated, because the CIA employs people to kill other people, and many of them either end up in prison or dead themselves. So if you'd like more information, what I could suggest is give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. You can find out about the books we carry, The Drugging of America by Rodney Stitch, Barry and the Boys, the four-tape set. It's entitled, Is There Really a War on Drugs? And you'll find out, of course, that there is not a war on drugs. The war is on the American people. We have a war on drugs, we get more drugs. We have a war on cancer, we get more cancer. We have a war on poverty, we get more poverty. We have a war against terrorism, which we've never even tried to get Osama bin Laden. Not really. Seriously, in fact, instead of getting Osama bin Laden, we went to war with Iraq. And that was what Richard Clark was complaining about. Tell me what's wrong with this story. If we're really concerned about the Al-Qaeda and the terrorists, why don't we simply use the facilities we have and end the war on terrorism instead of antagonizing the whole Islamic world? Had we gone after the people who attacked us, they would have understood. When we attack a country that is no threat to us, despite what our government says about the weapons of mass destruction, which are about to be launched on New York and upon Miami, Florida, and our nation's capital, and we can't wait another day. We have to move and move right now to protect the American people. And then we find out it's all a lie. But then why should we be surprised? The very essence of government is not telling the American people the truth. As Thomas Jefferson had said, speak in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And as Thomas Paine said, all societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil. And George Washington said, government is not eloquence, government is not persuasion, government is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant, but a fearful master. And at one time, our government's power was limited and we could be free, because liberty and limited government were synonymous. But that's no longer the case. Today we have a government that regulates every aspect of human endeavor, and it's collecting dossiers on every one of you. And if you doubt that, you need to get a copy of our latest newsletter. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. The Army is collecting dossiers on you. How do I know? Why? Because the head of NSA, the National Security Agency, William Odom, General William Odom, NSA, the most powerful secret organization in America, in his book, Fixing Intelligence, lets us know that the government's collecting dossiers on us. And he asks, should the Army be collecting dossiers on the American citizens? If you want to get a copy of our latest newsletter, that's the March newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the March newsletter, and then of course, we hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. We hope that many of you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God and righteousness can long endure, or if America, as with all other great empires, will soon be in the dustbin of history. So the choice is really yours. America doesn't have to die at this time. The question is, are there enough people out there with the courage to take a stand? It's been said that some men die in foxholes and some go down in flames, but most men die just bit by bit, playing foolish little games. What are you going to do in this battle? Well, seriously consider joining us. Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty. We're at the front line of this battle. So until tomorrow, at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.